This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Climate change amplifies extremes. In this show, we go from the coal pits of despair to a review of how natural systems will survive, whether we do or not. Zoologist Michael Mata Webster dips our toes in cautious hope with his new book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. Dr. Bill McGuire has a darker view. He spoke about his new work, Hothouse Earth, An Inhabitant's Guide. McGuire spoke recently with Allison Green from the group Scientists Warning. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Before we get to our interviews, let's cover a couple of minutes of news and breaking science that should be mainstream headlines, but never made it through the noise. Large conservative organizations are finally sounding the alarm about climate disaster, from the World Bank to the IEA. Just a decade or two ago, meteorologists still debated climate change. Most television weather people refused to say the words climate change or were outright deniers. That was then. This is now. Here are a few paragraphs from a press release in Geneva, September 13, 2022, from the World Meteorological Organization. Climate science is clear. We are heading in the wrong direction, according to a multi-agency report coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization, or the WMO. It highlights a huge gap between the aspirations and reality. Without much more ambitious action, the physical and socio-economic impacts of climate change will be increasingly devastating, it warns. The report, United in Science, shows that greenhouse gas concentrations continue to rise to record highs. Fossil fuel emission rates are now above pre-pandemic levels after a temporary drop due to lockdowns. The ambition of emissions reduction pledges for 2030 need to be 7 times higher to be in line with the 1.5 degree C goal of the Paris Agreement. The past 7 years were the warmest on record. There is a 48% chance that, during at least 1 year in the next 5, the annual mean temperature will be temporarily above 1.5 degrees C higher than the 1850 to 1900 average. As global warming increases, tipping points in the climate system cannot be ruled out, the WMO warns. Cities that host billions of people are responsible for up to 70% of human-caused emissions, and they will face increasing socioeconomic impacts. The most vulnerable populations will suffer most, says the report, which gives examples of extreme weather in different parts of the world this year. Floods, droughts, heat waves, extreme storms, and wildfires are going from bad to worse, breaking records with alarming frequencies. Heat waves in Europe, colossal floods in Pakistan, prolonged and severe droughts in China, the Horn of Africa, and the United States. There is nothing natural about the new scale of these disasters. They are the price of humanity's fossil fuel addiction, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. This year's United in Science report shows climate impacts heading into uncharted territory of destruction. Yet each year we double down on this fossil fuel addiction, even as symptoms get rapidly worse, Mr. Guterres says. So that's the head of the United Nations saying we're going into uncharted territory of destruction. Don't mind me here on Radio EcoShock. Here's another new one. Climate change rears up in unexpected ways and places. A new study published September 29 finds the waters of the Western Arctic Ocean are getting more acidic at a rate 3 to 4 times higher than in other ocean basins. They suggest this increase has been driven by the rapid loss of sea ice in the region, which has exposed carbon dioxide poor waters to the atmosphere where they can absorb more CO2. Suddenly, more acidic waters make it hard for any creature that needs calcium to make shells, like Alaska crab maybe, but even harder for the tiny shelled plankton at the base of the food chain. Find a link to this research in my show blog. Let's talk about going back to the familiar in a crisis. So many people, millions of them, badly want to return to the past. You can see that in politics. They see the old days through golden spectacles. Anyway, it must be better than a future in climate hell, a disintegrating economy, and ongoing pandemic. Climate activists fight this urge every day. Now the American Psychological Association has proved it in a study released October 6th. Ponder this from the APA press release. When people believe that a door is closing, that they have a limited amount of time left to enjoy something, such as dining out or traveling, they gravitate to the comfort of something familiar rather than the excitement of something new, according to a research published by the American Psychological Association. In 8 experiments with nearly 6,000 participants, researchers explored whether people tend to prefer novel, exciting experiences, such as trying a new restaurant, or familiar ones, such as returning to an old favorite, and whether those preferences shift with the amount of time believed that they have left to enjoy similar experiences. The research was published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. So, as climate change becomes more threatening, people you know will head out to buy gas-guzzling vehicles and fly the family to Fiji. They want to act out the past to ward off a future too threatening to think about. Nature has evolved ways for other creatures to survive shifts in climate, and although tens of thousands of species are on the brink of extinction, most living things will keep going, according to our next guest on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Are you longing to hear how bad it all is, that life is going extinct, and soon? Not going to happen, says Dr. Michael Maida Webster in his new book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. Dr. Webster is a zoologist, an academic scientist at Cornell and Oregon State. Michael also led the nonprofit group, the Coral Reef Alliance. From New York, Michael Webster, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Starting in on your new book, I was doubtful right from the beginning. Do you find yourself having to overcome people's predilection for doom these days?
That's a great opening question. Listen, I've worked in conservation for a long time, and we talk about, you know, doom and gloom a lot. And it's not that there isn't reason to be gloomy. There's plenty of negative things happening in the environment. And so, you know, I understand why that often takes center stage. But I don't think it's the whole story. And that's part of why I wanted to write this book, was to, you know, look at what's going on with nature and particularly with species around the world and ask some questions about, well, what are their capabilities for dealing with the kind of change we're creating? And at the same time, what aren't their capabilities and when should we be intervening?
So you come up with sort of 6 broad categories of ways that nature can respond to a crisis, and we find examples of them in the book. Maybe we should start off with one of them. Could you talk to us about phenotypic rescue and how that helps species survive extreme challenges?
Sure. And if it's okay, I'll just begin a little bit by saying, so the title of the book is The Rescue Effect. And, you know, I define the rescue effect in the book as nature's inherent tendency to rescue individuals and organisms when their environment is changing. And as you pointed out, by my count, there are 6 different ways that this works. One of them is phenotypic rescue. So a phenotype basically is, you know, the state that an organism is in. And in phenotypic rescue, what happens is for pretty much every kind of life on the planet, it's accustomed to a certain set of environmental conditions. When their environment changes, their phenotype will usually start to change, where the phenotype here is things like their physiology, like what genes are turned on or turned off in their genome. It could also be their behavior to try and avoid new threats in their environment, and in some cases, it can even be their appearance. Maybe they are camouflaged in a new way than they used to be. But those things, the physiology, the behavior, and the appearance, in biology, those are collectively called the phenotype. And what happens, usually pretty quickly, when organisms start to feel the environment changing, is that their phenotype will start to shift.
Well, maybe phenotypic rescue is what humans are attempting now in the face of global warming. We adapt our clothes, we install air conditioning. Eventually, humans will move away from flooding coastlines, we guess. So your book is aimed at the broad array of species, but do the 6 rescue effects apply to humans too?
Of course, and our phenotype adjusts all the time. You know, last time when I was acutely aware of this, I was hiking in the Himalaya at a higher elevation than I've ever been before, and you know, all sorts of things were getting triggered in my body, from the composition of my blood to my breathing to my pace, and all that was to make sure I was getting enough oxygen at the high elevation. My phenotype was shifting, and as you pointed out, humans have probably the greatest scope of phenotypic rescue of any species that's ever existed, because we are really good at adjusting our environment to suit our needs in the kinds of ways you've described.
And you begin Rescue Effect with the case of big cats, wild tigers. What is their status now, and how is it possible that every single tiger in an Indian government tiger reserve was killed?
Yeah, so tigers have had a difficult history for the last few hundred years as human populations have grown with rampant hunting and whatnot. Tiger populations have absolutely crashed. I think the estimate was that sometime around, you know, the early 1900s, there were about 100,000 of them on the planet. By the end of that century, there were about 3,000, at least in the wild. There's more tigers now, I believe, in captivity than there are in the wild. And so tigers have had a really fraught relationship with people, and they've been disappearing for a number of reasons. One is that in a lot of places, their habitat is being destroyed and they don't have a place to live. In other places, they're being hunted. And that's what happened in the park that I wrote about in India. In Banna Tiger Reserve in India, there was a healthy population of tigers that were systematically hunted out, largely to provide items for the wild animal trade, pelts and other parts of tigers that can be quite valuable. This was a huge embarrassment in India to lose all the tigers from this park. And as the story recounts in the book, they acted quickly to reintroduce tigers. And now those tigers in that park are doing extremely well. I was actually there a few months ago, and there's a lot of tigers in that park because they've rebounded. In this case, it took help from people. After humans exterminated them, humans reintroducing them gave them an opportunity to repopulate the park on their own. And they've done it quite impressively.
So do some of these rescues depend on a prior collapse of a species? For example, the reproductive rescue part of your book has language of increased reproduction, quote, in uncrowded conditions. Doesn't this suggest the rescue kicks in not at peak population, but after a significant crash?
Yeah, so the rescue effect, as I've described it, kicks in when change is happening, and change that has the potential to cause organisms harm. So I think your description there is correct. You know, reproductive rescue is this idea that when organisms are a little less crowded than they otherwise might be, they often experience good times where they've got more space to spread out in territories. They've got more food available to them. And you'll often see in organisms sort of a baby boom when their populations are reduced. This is actually the theory that modern fisheries are built on, which is if you remove some fish from the ocean or from a lake, their reproductive rate will go up. And they will replace the ones that you've removed, and theoretically, you can keep harvesting them, you know, forever in a system like that. And that's built on this idea of reproductive rescue, which is, for most organisms, when the abundance gets a little bit lower, their reproductive rate goes up. Now, there's a limit to this, because if you push down the population to the point where it's so low, you can actually get the other kind of effect where there aren't enough individuals to mate or reproduce, and they can sort of pass a point of no return as well.
I'd like to read a quick quote from your book, moving on to one of your other areas of expertise, the corals. You say, our oceans cover 3/4 of the Earth, and although coral reefs occur in only a tiny fraction of this expanse, less than 1% of the ocean floor, this sliver of habitat is crammed with roughly 25% of all ocean species, end quote. But we know coral reefs are threatened and some are dying in many places of the world. Michael, what happens to that 25% of all ocean species without living coral reefs?
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of the things that I've worked on most, which is coral reefs and trying to figure out a way, you know, can we help corals persist in that system? Because corals are building the habitat of the reef and they're creating the habitat for all those species that you're describing. I actually think that corals can persist despite the changes we're making, so long as we, you know, do get a handle on climate change in the future. But there is the question of what's going to happen to all that diversity. And listen, for those species that are most tied to the coral itself, if the coral disappears or becomes really rare, those species are going to disappear or become really rare. There are a lot of other species on a coral reef that can probably do just fine without the corals as long as there's a reef and some structure. I was just in Cozumel earlier this year, and frankly, the reefs that I saw had almost no coral on them. But there was a vibrant community of fish and other kinds of organisms on those reefs, but it's different from what it would be if you had a coral reef in that system. So, yep, losing corals absolutely puts some species at risk. Other ones are going to be able to adjust to different kinds of structures to live on.
You know, a few years ago, I interviewed top coral expert Charles Varon, and Charlie spent a lifetime literally writing the encyclopedia of coral types, only to see many of them die off in that same lifetime. And he was very sad about it. Does your book suggest there is a bright side for coral too?
So I think so. And I'm familiar with Dr. Varin's work, and you know, he's been one of the ones really sounding the alarm for corals, which I think is the right thing to do. You know, to me, corals can have a bright future, but it's going to require some action by us, particularly action on climate change. Organisms can adapt to changing environments. We know that. You know, we know that corals can adapt to living at higher temperatures. We've seen examples of that around the world in the past. But the thing that causes the most difficulty for many organisms is when things change really quickly. And that's what we've got going with climate change right now. It's a rate of change problem. For corals, it's getting too hot too fast, and we're losing some corals along the way. We've lost a lot already. If we want them to recover through these other aspects of the rescue effect, we're going to have to figure out a way to slow down that rate of change. In particular, we're going to have to figure out a way to slow the rate of warming on the planet.
Yes, and rising seas are part of that picture. We did an interview with a Texas scientist who said that corals had died off because the sea rose too quickly for them and left them in sort of plateaus or steps under the ocean. And so now we hear from Greenland that we have at least 10 inches of oceans committed, sea rising. That will also affect coral, will it not?
Absolutely. And it's really going to be a question, again, of how much change in sea level and how fast. You know, if you look at like the last ice age, roughly 25,000 years ago, places like the Great Barrier Reef, that's where the shoreline of Australia was, you know, 250 miles offshore. Those areas, I think, have risen on the order of 200 feet since the last ice age. And the corals in that system have been able to grow to keep pace with 200 feet of change in sea level. That's kind of amazing. But they had a little bit of time to do it. You know, that would have taken place over thousands of years. If we are imagining that kind of sea level rise in a much shorter period of time, corals are going to get stuck down too deep in the ocean where they can't photosynthesize. They don't get enough light down there because it gets filtered up by the water. This will be especially a problem for coral systems like that are common in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific called coral atolls, where you have a whole island that's just being made out of coral and other organisms that are building the structure. If sea level rises too fast, you risk having those effectively, you know, drowned where the corals are too deep to be able to keep growing. For coastal areas, like along the edges of high islands or continents, the places where coral reefs will just shift as the sea level rises. So those are not places where that same exact problem will happen. But yeah, sea level rise could be a huge problem for corals.
Now, some scientists say we are already in a global mass extinction event. We hear about that from the bugs on to the birds. Is the current rate of extinction relatively low from your perspective? And if so, why do you think that is?
The current rate of extinction is much higher because of us. The estimates in the scientific literature include estimates that we've increased the extinction rate about 1,000-fold. And so a 1,000-fold increase, that's big. But it's a big increase on something that was very low. And so if you think about something like an extinction crisis, what that implies is we're actively losing a large fraction of the diversity on the planet. The good news is we're not there yet. What's happening right now is the risks are going up. At least in terms of what we have documented, we haven't documented very many species extinctions on the planet. Some small fraction of 1% of the species have been lost due to extinction. So proportionally, it's quite low, at least what's been documented so far. The more worrisome thing is that the number of species that are at risk is growing. But even when we look at those numbers, they're not that high yet. For example, you can look at the IUCN's Red List, which is the world's most comprehensive database for at-risk species. And if you look at how many species are listed as threatened or endangered or critically endangered, right now it's about 40,000. And 40,000 is a huge number. I mean, try to imagine 40,000 different species. That's a lot of species. But compared to the life on the planet, which is, as far as we know so far, we've described about 2 million species, we're talking about roughly 2% of what's out there. Now, obviously, it's an underestimate because there's lots of things we haven't looked at yet, but we're not at the point where most species are threatened or endangered with extinction. It's actually a pretty small percentage that are in that category right now. They're species we care about and species we should try and save, but we haven't gotten to the point where we're at risk of losing large fractions of Earth's diversity. We could get there, but I actually take some comfort in the notion that we're not there yet, and we've got time to act if we can just convince ourselves to do so.
Of your six rescue effects, I was thinking we would leave out of our conversation evolutionary rescue because evolution isn't likely to save much in the next 100 years of extreme environmental change. Or is that true?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because in conservation, evolution was oftentimes in the past sort of considered to be sort of a non-factor, that evolution was too slow to make much of a difference in a changing world. And I think that that comes from sort of our vision of evolution as this slow process that takes place over millions of years as new branches of the tree of life are grown. And that's true in as far as it goes, but species can also evolve really quickly. In fact, they can evolve almost instantaneously if you've got a couple of conditions. So if a species is going to evolve quickly, there has to be some diversity in the population where some individuals are better at something than others. If, you know, for example, with corals, some corals are naturally better able at dealing with high temperatures than other corals. If you get high temperatures in the water and the sensitive corals die and the more tolerant corals survive, if that tolerance is coded by their genetic code, you've had an instantaneous evolution event because your population afterward has a new average trait. And so evolution can happen very quickly if the diversity is out there. And what we're seeing, the more we look in conservation, is we're starting to see examples of this happening. It's not the easiest thing in the world to measure, but it is happening, and it's happening at the time frame at which the environment is changing. A lot of the work that I've done on corals recently has been trying to figure out, can they keep pace? Can evolutionary rescue happen fast enough? And so we've been trying to model the biological capability of corals to run scenarios. And, you know, those scenarios are not, you know, there are some scenarios that are bad, especially if we don't do anything about climate change. But if we do, they're actually reasonably optimistic for what corals can do, and a lot of that has to do with their evolution.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now, Michael, we come to a few thorns. One reason for your relative optimism about the species, if none of the six natural rescue effects saves them, maybe humans will. But we have more of a record for killing things than saving them, don't you think?
I mean, sure, we cause plenty of problems for plenty of species, but if you look at places like North America, I mean, how many species do you know of that have gone extinct recently? There actually aren't very many. Earlier this year, there was news that the ivory-billed woodpecker had been finally declared extinct. Well, it's taken 100 years of worrying about that species to get to that stage. And, you know, while I would prefer for the ivory-billed woodpecker to be on the planet, we're not seeing species disappear from places like North America in droves today. And a lot of that has to do with the things we've done to try and save them through the Endangered Species Act and other tools. People have intervened on behalf of species to try and help them persist. And, you know, if we put our minds to it, in most cases, we can help them. There are, I'm sure you can come up with examples of where, you know, all the effort in the world isn't going to do it. But for most species, we can intervene on their behalf, and we actually know how to pretty well in most cases. We have a pretty well-established set of tools in conservation that we can use to help species persist. And, you know, in the worst-case scenarios, we can maintain them in captivity if they no longer have a habitable place to live in the environment. While nobody wants that to be the conclusion, you know, even in that most extreme case, we can usually ward off extinction.
Few people in North America living now would know giant forests of chestnut trees once covered the east and the south. What happened to the American chestnut? And please tell us about the newer high-tech efforts to restore them.
Sure. The American chestnut was once one of the major trees in eastern forests, especially throughout Appalachia. And they were a really important tree for timber, for production of chestnuts, as well as for habitat for wildlife. And people really relied on them. In about 1904, a new disease was discovered on chestnut trees in what's now the Bronx Zoo. And it was a disease that had been imported from different species of chestnut trees that live in Asia. Well, it turned out that the American chestnut trees were really not capable of fighting off this disease, and they died in droves. By some estimates, every single standing American chestnut tree died between about 1904 and around 1940. And people looked for surviving trees that maybe had an ability to fight this new fungal disease, but they really couldn't find very much. And the few that survived a bit longer were not particularly good at fighting the disease. And so what they realized is if you wanted to have American chestnut trees or something like an American chestnut tree, it was going to have some capability that the species didn't have to fight this new disease. people first started hybridizing the American trees with different species from Asia of chestnuts to create this sort of species mixture with the hopes that it would sort of look and taste and be like an American chestnut tree, but have the resistance of the Asian trees that had evolved with the disease. That's gotten some success, and all that breeding has produced some trees that can, you know, fight off the chestnut blight better than other species, or better than the wild trees from a century ago. But the real change in the conversation around American chestnuts has been more recently, when a group of researchers at the State University of New York in Syracuse created a genetically modified American chestnut tree that has one important new gene that was borrowed from wheat. And this gene in wheat helps wheat fight fungal infections. They put the gene into American chestnut trees, and now these new transgenic American chestnut trees do a better job at fighting the disease. And the people who are working on this would like to start planting these trees more broadly. And so that, as you can imagine, is opening up a big conversation about genetically modified organisms. And is that something that is okay for conservation purposes? And, you know, what's the greater evil in this case? Is it allowing a species to go extinct, or is it using genetic modification in order to save it?
Michael, I get the feeling you think it's time to take those risks, including geoengineering species, if that's what it takes. What do you think?
So I've actually tried pretty hard in my book not to try and tell my readers what I think the right answer is. I'm actually more interested in having them think about it from different perspectives and try and make the call for themselves. The reality is that conservation decisions are almost always judgment calls. They're almost always based on different values that people have, and sometimes those values are in conflict. And it's in, you know, civil society where a lot of these decisions will be made, and I think that's probably the right place for it. I think people should be weighing in on what they think is the right answer and trying to come to conclusions. It's going to, you know, lead to fights for sure, and it's going to lead to lots of difficult questions. Part of the reason for writing my book is that there's no question that these difficult decisions are coming. I'd like for people to know, you know, something about what they entail so that when it comes to the species they care about or the place they care about, they're armed with some information about what the alternatives are and can help make up their own mind about what they think the right answer is.
Yeah, I appreciate that in the book. There's a lot of honesty there. You acknowledge critics, point us to people and places we can look up different opposing views. So that is really cool. Now, what is de-extinction?
So de-extinction is a sort of a new avenue in conservation that basically says, for things that have already gone extinct, is it possible to somehow recreate them, to resurrect a lost extinct species? The species that we probably hear the most about in this regard is the woolly mammoth. And because we find things like woolly mammoth bones and fur in melting permafrost, maybe we could use that genetic information from what a woolly mammoth once was to create something that is something like a woolly mammoth going forward.
Here in British Columbia, thousands of people have been arrested trying to stop loggers from chopping down old-growth forests. And many of us love and want to protect those old giant trees. Does your book suggest this is a mistake?
No, not at all. I mean, I've actually worked a lot in British Columbia in the past on some of those issues. And to me, what you're doing is you're exercising your values. And you are asserting what you think is important in the system, and you're standing up to be heard. I totally respect that. One thing I would caution you about, just to think about in the future, is that with the environment changing, it may be that whether you cut those old growth trees down or not, you may start losing them, because the old growth trees are expecting an environment like what was there when they started growing, which was a long, long time ago. Phenotypic rescue will get them a little ways toward adjusting to changing conditions, but we're probably going to see even well-protected old growth forests turning over in the next, you know, decades to come, as the environment changes enough that those trees that were the right trees there 500 years ago are maybe not the trees that are going to succeed going forward. What I would suggest to you is, if that happens, you know, think about the value of those next generations of trees and what they represent in terms of that system adapting to a changing environment. While I like old growth forests myself, I love being in them, I love the fact that they exist, I also really respect those young trees that are taking over when the environment changes.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Michael Webster, educator, environmentalist, and zoologist author of the new book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. It's interesting, after your really lifetime of work in conservation, you've come to almost a new vision of what we should expect, and it isn't to restore the grandeur of the past. It's to look towards a different future and accept that? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And listen, you can arrive at that conclusion for two different reasons. One, you can just say it's the pragmatic conclusion, which is the world is changing. The expectation that nature is going to stay the same is just, it won't work. Nature changes in response to the environment that it experiences, especially with things like climate change that are permeating all ecosystems. All ecosystems are in the process of change. Now, to be fair, they always were, because climates are not, you know, stable over, you know, extremely long periods of time. Ecosystems are always changing, but they're changing very quickly right now. And so the pragmatist says, okay, they're going to change. Well, how do we work with that? Fine. But I actually think there's another level here, which in some ways is even more inspiring, which is it's the fact that nature is capable of change and those processes that underlie it. That's something that's really beautiful about nature in and of itself. And that's something that I think is worthy of admiration.
Do you think there is somewhere in life a kind of intentional design for these rescue effects?
I don't think so in the way that you're asking that question. I would describe it differently, which is life has been on this planet for something like 3 billion years. The only forms that have managed to persist in lineages going back 3 billion years are the ones that are particularly good at persisting. And so it has been various forms of selection where the organisms that weren't good at this, they disappeared a long time ago. You know, far more species have disappeared than are on the planet right now. And so we've lost the ones that weren't particularly good at dealing with environmental change. What we're left with is the ones that managed to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that every species today on the planet is good at dealing with environmental change. It means that they all have this within their lineages. And so the expectation is that, all else being equal, the species around today are going to be pretty good at dealing with change.
After hearing scientists explain the direction of climate change, I get worried emails from listeners. But I have not personally reached the expected state of climate grief. Is it possible some humans have a greater tendency towards optimism than others? And why does optimism sometimes feel like a betrayal of the search for truth?
Yeah, so I'm not a human psychologist, so I can't give you a deeply insightful answer on these, but I think there is variation. I think some people do naturally focus on the negatives and the loss. And, you know, I don't have an inherent problem with that. I do tend to be a little bit more optimistic, and so, you know, you probably see that coming out in my writing as well. But humans are incredibly good at adapting to changing environments, probably the best species ever at being able to do so. And so, you know, to some extent, no matter what happens, we will find ways of adjusting. I'd just like to see us collectively act in ways that slows down the rate of that change tremendously.
Aside from your new book, Michael, what are you working on these days?
So I'm doing, continuing to do work on coral reefs. You know, that's been the system that I focused on the most. And the questions there are really about, can corals adapt to changing environments fast enough? And what can we do to help them? Are there ways we can speed up things like evolutionary rescue to help corals persist? So I'm doing that kind of work. I'm also, I've been teaching at Cornell and now NYU.
From New York and Cornell University, we have been speaking with Dr. Michael Mehta Webster. You are brave enough to think outside the box, so Michael's new book is The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. Find out more in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Hello and welcome to Scientist Warning TV. And today I'm delighted to be talking again with Professor Bill McGuire, the academic, activist, broadcaster and blogger, and Emeritus Professor of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at UCL. And Bill has in recent years become a prolific writer, communicator and advocate. He's the author of numerous books, including Sky Seed, which is a cautionary tale and a very interesting tale about the hazards of geoengineering. And then recently he wrote a new book, Hothouse Earth, in which he writes that the post-COP26 reality is this: to have even the tiniest chance of keeping the global average temperature rise below 1.5 degrees C, we need to see emissions down 45% by 2030. And in theory, this might be possible, but in the real world, barring some unforeseen miracle, it isn't going to happen. Now, that's going to be a very triggering statement for some. I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, some people may be concerned about it, but that's simply a fact. I don't know why people are still going on about 1.5 degrees C when at the same time they talk of needing a 45% cut in emissions. I mean, the two things just don't go together. We've got something like 90 months to reduce emissions by nearly a half when there's been no sign of a reduction of in emissions globally ever. Apart from a little blip when COVID-19 really hit home. So, it's just not sensible and it's not right to keep giving the impression that we can stay this side of 1.5 degrees.
This debate around 1.5 and whether we should, whether it's dead in the water, as some yourself and others like Kevin Anderson would say, it's become controversial because there's almost a sense in which, some scientists are hanging on to the fact that it's still geophysically possible. In fact, it may not yet be. And it's the sense in which we have to hang on to the possibility, because without that as a possibility, it seems, I think there's a fear that there will be despair and that people will give up and that we'll be in an even worse position. And it's something that perhaps we can return to, because it's something you talk about in your book about this, the importance of being truthful and being brutally honest about where we really are. None of the world's biggest economies, which together generate 80% of carbon emissions, are on target to keep the promises they made in Paris. So before we actually go on to talk about the book, I just would like to get your views on where we are now in terms of the Paris goal. I mean, you've just said that, you think it's lost. But of course, people will say that, every fraction of a degree matters. So where are we in terms of the science?
I think we have lost 1.5 degrees because countries simply aren't doing enough. I mean, some are doing better than others. The UK is doing moderately well, although when it counts its emissions reductions, it doesn't tend to count aviation and shipping those emissions associated with consumerism. So even we aren't doing as much as we need. And many other countries have hardly changed at all. So Paris is dead in the water. 1.5 degrees is dead in the water. And to be honest, 1.5 degrees has sort of become this iconic landmark, which is supposed to equate to dangerous climate change. But there's no evidence that 1.5 degrees coincides with dangerous climate change. It could easily be 1.4. It could be 1.6. Mm-hmm. So to give it this massive relevance, it is really a bit misleading. And as you said just now, every 0.1 degree centigrade is critical. So we need to act to keep temperatures as low as we possibly can, but not get hung up on a target that we're not going to reach.
Yes, and you're right, because if there is a growing consensus that that target is in fact lost, then it does beg the question, what's the new target? Should there be a new target? It shouldn't be 2 degrees, clearly, but, it's a very dangerous zone into which we're straying. And I think you're absolutely right that the fixation on a target has been really deeply problematic all along.
There's a point of view that a bad target is worse than no target at all. All the targets that we have to choose from are all bad, effectively. And all we can do is cut emissions as fast as we possibly can. And that needs huge leadership from governments across the planet, which just isn't there yet.
You're right. And although in nations like the UK and US, there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of fine talk, and as Greta would say, fine words, but it's really not translating into action. And you could say arguably in the UK with the new prime minister and talking about, resuming fracking, we're just heading in the wrong direction, which is terrifying. But in Hothouse Earth, which is a book which is both eloquent and really terrifying, and you give a very clear sense that things could get much worse, really very much worse, if the radical transformation that's actually called for in the IPCC reports doesn't happen. Now, if some heating is already baked in, and as many people say it is, including the UK's Committee on Climate Change, what can we expect between now and 2050 if we sort of trundle along this trajectory that we seem to be on?
Well, the reason the book's called An Inhabitant's Guide is because many people around today are going to be living in a world with these new conditions. We got a glimpse of it in this summer because we saw these incredible heat waves across Europe and North America and many other parts of the world. We saw catastrophic floods as far apart as Nigeria, Pakistan, the US, all over the planet, really. And the staggering thing is how quickly a small global average temperature change is translating into extreme weather. It's happening far more quickly, I think, than anybody expected. So we're going to see in the decades ahead more of the same. I mean, every year now, we're seeing baking summers across the planet. The temperatures are going to get up to 50 degrees C plus in Europe, maybe as early as next year if it's an El Nino year. And of course, they've already got up to over 48 degrees now. Similar conditions will become more and more common across land areas right across the planet. And just really, things will start ramping up in terms of extreme weather. So the infrastructure will start to suffer, communications, transport, water supplies. Obviously, drought is going to be a massive problem in the future. And the UN just said the other day that 345 million people this year are marching towards starvation. Mm. Also, we've got food shortages predicted in the UK and France. And another report just last week suggested that in half of the world's countries, civil unrest could be expected in the next few months, including in the UK, because of a conspiracy, really, of energy problems, food prices, inflation, and the impacts of climate change. Now that, you know, we're already seeing what we're going to see later on this century. It's just what we've been experiencing at the moment, only writ much larger.
Exactly. And these things are just coming down the tracks at us right now. They're actually here and now and affecting us here and now. I read today a very strange article again in The Guardian about some sort of brain-eating amoeba, the prevalence of which had increased due to the increase in temperatures. It's one of those strange headlines, sort of do a double take and then think, gosh, well, how many other unforeseen, unexpected and really strange and very deeply unpleasant things are coming down the tracks, but we've not yet got sight of them.
Yeah, well, there are things in the book I call stings in the tail, and some people may have heard of these. We're talking about the shutdown of the Atlantic conveyor, the Gulf Stream and the other currents that keep Western Europe and the UK warmer than it otherwise would be. That is in a state of almost complete instability at the moment, and it could begin to slow dramatically or fail, certainly within the next 80 years, maybe sooner than that. Then you have the issue of thawing permafrost in across the tundra of Siberia and Canada, and this idea of giant methane burps, which can produce huge amounts of methane, pump it out into the atmosphere very quickly. Now, there's no evidence that happened in past episodes of heating, but the absence of that evidence isn't evidence of absence. So we really don't know how the methane is going to behave. And of course, methane is 86 times more effective at warming the planet than carbon dioxide. Yeah. And then you have other things, an area which I've worked on, which is where you lose a lot of ice or you raise sea level considerably, you actually change the stress patterns within the crust so that you can promote earthquake activity, you can promote volcanic activity. So you may actually have a geological response to climate change as things really start to ramp up. So yes, there are lots of what you might call known unknowns, but there are unknown unknowns as well. And of course, we don't know what they are.
It's absolutely. And the one about the volcanoes that you write about in your book, about the rising sea level and how that sort of will affect one side of a volcano. And then the magma then erupts a bit like toothpaste, I think you say in the book.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful image. But of course, it raises other questions, too, around the fact that, you know, we're kind of to what you might call a standard volcanic eruption. We know what to expect when volcanoes erupt. But under these changed circumstances, would that change the nature of the eruption? Would it amplify it? Would it lead to more devastation? I mean, I know you're a volcanologist, so perhaps it's something that you could comment on.
The idea is that changes in the stress regime within the crust would cause volcanoes that had magma already sitting there to erupt that magma earlier than they would otherwise. So you could get a clustering of eruptions that were ready to go. But it's the earthquake situation that's more worrying. Where you've had 2 or 3 kilometres of ice sitting on top of active faults and that ice melts rapidly, you can trigger huge earthquakes If we go back to the end of the last ice age, when the big faults in Scandinavia were being unstressed, if you like, by the removal of ice, you had magnitude 8 earthquakes. That's as big as we see normally around the Pacific Rim, around the Ring of Fire. And a big worry is Greenland, because it's in exactly the same situation as Scandinavia was 10,000 years ago. If that ice starts to melt rapidly, the crust underneath starts to bounce back, which it already is doing, incidentally, in the Greenland area. That results in a lessening of stresses on faults. And if there are faults underneath there, they won't have moved for hundreds of thousands of years. So they could generate massive earthquakes, which could produce submarine landslides, and that in turn could produce tsunamis. This has happened at the end of the last ice age. So there are these sorts of things which people aren't really that aware of, which could result in massive threats.
Yes, and it all adds up to a terrifying near-term future. So you were at the centre of the controversy when The Guardian published an article that you had written, but they produced the headline for it. Have there been expressions of relief in the sense that you are now publicly saying what some scientists privately feel and believe?
Well, the article was really interesting. It was in The Observer, actually, rather than The Guardian. Ah. And it was written by a reporter. It was written by Robin McKee, who's an excellent journalist. And the article was accurate, entirely accurate, and described what my book was about and what I said to him. The problem was the headline was in two parts, and the second part said something like, "Total climate meltdown is now unstoppable," which isn't what I said, and it's not what the article said. And that only appeared on the online version. It wasn't in the newspaper. And it did cause a little bit of consternation, although I have to say I've had very little comeback from climate scientists. Maybe one or two make comments on Twitter, and I just replied that I had nothing to do with the headline, and that's not what the article says or the book. And people were quite happy with that. They said something like along the lines of, "Oh, I'm glad to hear it." And the article headline was changed just a few days later. Everybody seem to have been reasonably happy. And I've had no people contact me saying that my stand at 1.5 degrees is not practically possible, is out of order. No one has said that.
That's interesting, because it does speak to that point about, privately, your colleagues, those in the scientific community will concur with you. But it's just the fact that publicly so few people are prepared to say that. And it's this scientific reticence, perhaps. Perhaps it's this feeling of responsibility. Perhaps it's this feeling of scientists aren't supposed to give opinions. They're supposed to be independent. They're supposed to stick with the facts. And it's a difficult one, because if scientists can't speak out, be advocates, or in your case, activists and advocates too, then who else can? Because the public are obviously looking for some guidance on this matter, and they're clearly not getting the guidance from politicians. So where can that guidance be found?
Well, we're not talking about some academic exercise here. We're talking about the future of our planet and our society. Everybody working in the field who thinks 1.5 degrees is no longer possible should be saying that. There's no excuse for it. If people are concerned that, it might affect their grant application outcomes or their peer review, peers may laugh at them or whatever. Those are secondary issues. They don't even register on the radar, given the desperate straits that we're in. So everyone has a duty to do this. And I know, many scientists are still coming out and saying this. I mean, Scientist Rebellion have a lot of great guys in there who support this idea. It's not an idea. I mean, you just need to look at the figures and know it's going to happen. But there is support out there, and it's growing, I think.
I think you're right. And I'd like to come back to that point when we look at the relationship between knowledge, the privilege of being an academic, and the responsibility that goes with that. But I want to just touch on something that you mentioned about the La Nina events and so forth. So we've just been announced that we have just entered the century's first three-year La Nina event. And given the rarity of such an event, perhaps 4 in a century, next year would seem set to swing towards a hot La Nina phase, which could raise global average temperatures in the short term over the next El Nino phase. So given the recent extreme weather events and record-breaking temperatures, and there's been quite a proliferation of workshops and events centering on tipping points, should this give us significant additional concern into next year?
Yeah, I think we should be really concerned, because a 3-year La Nina is very unusual. It might extend into the early part of next year. But then it may well switch to El Nino conditions, which means a much hotter equatorial Pacific. And that is always also associated with a much hotter planet overall. Now, over the last 5 years, the average global temperature rise compared to pre-industrial times is just a shade under 1.3 degrees C. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you had a really strong El Nino following up next year and maybe the year after. I wouldn't be surprised to see 1.5 degrees broken during that event. It would probably be temporary. But, you know, 5 years now of almost 1.3 and then a 1.5, we're getting to that time when we will see a 1.5 degrees C increase being maintained over many years. In other words, we'll have broken through that barrier. I wouldn't be surprised to see us through it within 10 years.
Yes, and that's shocking. And an observation made to me by a scientist some months ago is that, yeah, experiencing 1.5 degrees on the way up, if we accept that we're going to overshoot, will not necessarily be the same as experiencing a return to 1.5 degrees on the way back down again, because we might have crossed a number of tipping points.
Exactly.
Which is perhaps something that, yeah, that the public isn't perhaps as aware of as they might need to be.
Yeah, well, as you say, as the temperature ramps up, if we cross tipping points, like, for example, the loss of the Greenland ice sheet, even if we bring the temperature down by whatever means we do, and there's no certainty that we can even do that, that tipping point will stay tipped. So, you know, the Greenland ice sheet would go. Yes. And the other point is the maximum temperature we reach, we will hang around at that temperature for several decades, maybe centuries. So you know, things aren't going to come down again unless we take carbon out of the air in a wholesale manner, which is another huge can of worms we probably don't want to open at the moment.
Exactly. And it brings me to another point, which is that, I mean, it must be extremely confusing for the public and perhaps for some policymakers when within the scientific community there are these divided opinions, with a number of scientists talking about the implausibility of carbon capture and storage, the you know, the problems associated with trying to scale something like that. And on the other hand, there are other scientists, some here in Cambridge, who talk about geoengineering. As if it's something that's feasible. And so given that there are these at times these quite divergent views expressed by experts within the scientific community, it's hard to see, you know, how to reconcile those views and how those views could be reconciled in such a way that they make sense to those on the ground who are making decisions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to find that climate scientists are not supporters of geoengineering, but engineers are, and maybe to some extent physicists, because they like to tinker, whereas climate scientists can look and see what sort of havoc we've already caused by tinkering with the climate. But there's one thing that affects all these geoengineering schemes, and that is that they may work okay on a small scale, but to roll them out globally to such a degree that they will counteract 40 billion tons of carbon being released, carbon dioxide being released every year, is just staggering. I mean, an initiative like that is comparable to an initiative which would slash emissions, and we're finding it very difficult to do that on a global scale. So how the hell are we going to, at the same time, launch a global geoengineering scheme that is, you know, is frankly just, it's a distraction from what we really need to do. It tackles the symptoms and not the cause of global heating. And we don't need distractions now.
Exactly. And I wonder if it's, you know, if that kind of techno-optimism sort of harks back to the 1960s when, you know, people thought, well, if we can get a man on the moon, you know, surely we can crack this one.
But it was people like Edward Teller who were originally very keen on weather engineering, and that was so that it could be used as a weapon of war. So, you know, that's where it all came from originally. And it's just, as I said earlier, a can of worms we just don't want to open.
And we don't have to. This is the rub. We don't have to, because the solutions and what we need to do is blindingly obvious. It's staring us right in the face, as you say. It's about slashing carbon emissions immediately. So going back to the book, at the end of the book, you describe two alternative scenarios for an August bank holiday weekend in London, one of which depicts the blistering hot days with temperatures reaching 44 degrees C, which is just sounds horrendous, with everyone having to stay inside their homes to avoid the heat. You talk about the thick clouds of dust and the River Thames just being awash with sewage. And it's an absolutely horrible, nightmarish vision. You contrast this with another vision in which we have a picture of it's a still hot, but it's a green and lively city. It's busy with bicycles, with public transport, with people walking around in parks and with the streets barely visible because of the canopy of trees. And it's devoid of pollution of cars because the adaptations that we need to make now have actually been made. And in reading those two visions, obviously one of them is much more appealing, clearly. But what occurred to me was that for the average member of the public, neither of those scenarios would seem to be something that they would have in mind. They wouldn't necessarily seem to be recognisable. And it seems that just as sort of denialism and doomism and so forth would lead a minority of people towards the more apocalyptic vision. But for some people, that would be something that would not be entertained. But the one of the radical transformation, it seems to me, similarly, would not necessarily be entertained because we don't have people. We don't have sufficient people talking about those sort of new visions about how society could be. I mean, you've obviously done this in your book. Other people like Paul Chatterton, for example, talks about the ways in which cities could be transformed. So it's a really big question, but what are we going to do to change this?
Well, it's on the one hand, I've always thought that we're not going to see major action on emissions until the impacts of dangerous climate breakdown become so apparent that they simply can't be avoided, and their effect on economy and society become huge. And the problem with that is that it's probably not going to happen until temperatures are heading towards 2 degrees C. Mm-hmm. So it would be too late then to stop pretty calamitous climate breakdown. But there's nothing I can see which is going to make today's world leaders and today's governments change in order to slash emissions by half within 10 years and bring emissions down to net zero by 2050, which in any case is too late, really. I just can't see that happening. It's a pessimistic viewpoint, and I hope I'm wrong, but I've always thought this. Governments won't change, world leaders won't change until they're forced to, or until their people force them to.
Absolutely. And, there was great hope with Extinction Rebellion that the Extinction Rebellion numbers would grow and that the pressure would come via that huge movement. And it's disappointing that it hasn't happened yet. I mean, like you, I'm sure, but I still hope that they will be part of creating that really important social tipping point that we need.
That was Alison Green from Scientists Warning with Dr. Bill McGuire, author of the new book Hot House Earth, An Inhabitant's Guide. Find links to the full YouTube presentation, Scientists Warning and Bill's book in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening this week, for better or for worse, and thank you for caring about our world.